Summertime is...
So welcome to Country Western Tuesday. Thought we'd try something different. Although now I'm supposed to have Hannah Montana Thursday, I think.
So,
got to remember that one. Apparently what I have to do is run a, you know, playlist request. Welcome to Lecture 17, March 15th, Ides of March. Beware the Ides of March. Lecture notes page... Ides of March?
Julius Caesar,
the day that he was warned about and that he was killed by his colleagues. Lecture notes, page 150. I did hit record. Face covering. Face covering? Eventually, I presume they'll change that rule, but... So what do we know? We know that extra credit number 5 is closing this coming Thursday. We know that mini test 8 closes tonight. Having been open for the usual time period, we know spring break is coming up in a couple weeks, and just after spring break, that Wednesday, we're going to open midterm 2. No surprises there, because you know it. Webbies, you know it too, right? You're paying attention. All right, so here we are on the calendar. Next week, I'll roll the calendar up so we can see the midterm coming at us. Same information here. What else is new? I guess the update there is the unchanging. It's the average for the Enhanced Reading Extra Credit and PACBACK, 2.28. And overall, across the numbers, both have added 1.4% to their final course grade. Good job for you guys. Test results, we can't update yet because it's not closed. So, business in the news. This poor guy, I can't imagine how he went through high school. His name is Christopher Cox. And Chris Cox is from Ohio. I tried to find out where. I can't find that out. But Chris Cox is Hasbro's new gamer-in-chief. He's the new president and CEO, whatever. So Chris Cox played with G.I. Joe and Transformers action figures as a child. Then he moved on to Dungeons and Dragons and Magic. Any guys Dungeon and Dragon folk? Any guys Magic, the Gathering folk? Okay, so usually it's just you and me, but you have a kindred spirit back there behind you. So. So The Gathering. He's still playing both at 48. He now runs the company that makes all of those products. His goal is to sell more stuff to the people who, like him, never stop gaming. So that's their growth strategy. Mr. Cox is trying to broaden the company's focus beyond younger children who play with Play-Doh, which Hasbro creates, Nerf Blasters, and My Little Pony dolls, which Hasbro, how about My Little Pony people? From back in the day, sort of, no, yeah, a little bit. The Ohio native, who calls himself a professional adult kid, said he sees growth opportunities in older consumers who are fans of games like Dungeon & Dragon and collect retro toys like G.I. Joe, so growth via some new consumers as well. I don't think about Hasbro as a toy company for kids, he says. I think of it as an entertainment company for people of all ages, so sort of the company vision, not being too narrow. Hasbro, for more than a decade, has been guided by what he calls the brand blueprint. This brand blueprint strategy focuses on developing engaging stories behind the Hasbro brands, which in turn then spur sales of toys, digital games, other merchandise like shirts and backpacks. Hasbro credits the blueprint for the production of Transformers and My Little Pony movies and a rise in sales from products tied to those franchises. So there's their brand strategy. Mr. Cox laid out a possible application for Dungeons & Dragons, a fantasy board game introduced nearly 50 years ago. While people start playing the game at around age of 11 or 12, Mr. Cox said there could be opportunities to introduce younger kids to the game through toys like action figures. Hasbro also could develop movies or shows based on the game for the older consumers who played it when they were younger. So new product ideas to keep it fresh and growing. Mr. Cox's view to expand Hasbro's target market of consumers away from kids stemmed from a meeting around 2005 during his time at Microsoft. Visiting Coca-Cola executives to Microsoft described how the beverage giant redefined its market, its consumers, expanding beyond sugary drinks to include any consumable liquid, including tap water, which of course has played out pretty well for them in bottled water. I think of age limits in that same way. We need to be broad, we can't be narrow. So developing his corporate strategy. McDonald's embraces Gen Z aesthetic to push its coffee. For years, armed with Starbucks pumpkin spice lattes, millennials have defined trends in coffee culture. However, Gen Z influence on the humble cup of Joe is growing. So we're understanding, once again, the influence of different age cohorts on culture and the marketplace. That's why McDonald's is targeting the younger generation in this latest work from a cafe in the Gulf region of the Middle East. So we're seeing a bit about McDonald's global marketing strategy, their growth strategy, and their target market. McDonald's new For Every Beat of the Day campaign looks to encapsulate energy and pulse of the young generation. So the ad campaign theme. McDonald's said the push is based on its insight that young coffee drinkers feel invincible when armed with a paper cup of coffee in hand. I'd be interested in that research, you know, what the focus group looked like. Hey, you're going out, you bought a McCafe, you're walking down the street. How does that make you feel? And I guess over time, what comes is the invincible. Who feels invincible when they have a cup of coffee in their hand? Who feels bold? Who feels better? I feel awaker. Anyhow, that's their research into consumer behavior in the Gulf region of the Middle East. The campaign explores real moments in the 24-hour coffee culture we live in. It'll run across digital and TV. Let's see how they put this together, this idea, into an ad. Beat of the day, McDonald's McCafe. The TV ad captures authentic moments in multiple locations across that region. It's a marriage of high exposure pics and film with multi-format approach designed to reflect the joys of a fresh brew and unexpected pleasures and surprises that punctuate life. All this is steered by a drum track, which I personally found irritating, but others may find interesting or attention-getting, because I'm not a Gen Zer, sorry. Created to mirror people's body clocks and how they tick throughout the day from morning to noon and night. Our customers' expectations and coffee drinking habits are changing. We recognize that Gen Z in particular need a good cup of coffee that matches their on-the-go lifestyle. McDonald's is increasingly investing in its McCafe proposition to drive sales. In its most recent annual report, the fast food giant said markets globally are planning to leverage the McCafe brand, experience, value, and quality to drive long-term growth. So here we're seeing a bit about their brand strategy for growth. This next story was not in my original plan for today because I'm a little depressed by having to talk about the war that's going on, yet I felt it necessary to include this next story. So this is Marking the News, the War Edition. So McDonald's, new threat in Russia, loss of its reputation. McDonald's is facing another reputational threat in Russia as the government there considers lifting restrictions on trademarks for companies that have stopped doing business there. We don't think that much in general about trademark protection, intellectual property protection, but think what that means. You've spent 30 years, in McDonald's case, building up who they are in a global country, in a foreign country. Service, quality, product, meat, potatoes, and now it's going to be gone. And anybody can open a McDonald's, Golden Arches McDonald's, and sell something called a Big Mac with any product they want. I'll continue the story, but there goes your intellectual property rights because of the situation. There goes your reputation. So global marketing, regulatory, legal, and political factors in marketing. Russia's Ministry of Economic Development last week said it was considering such a move. Already it has essentially legalized patent theft from those affiliated with unfriendly countries. The change on trademarks could mean that Russia might reopen some of the 847 McDonald's restaurants in the country, which is a Chicago-based company, temporarily closed this week amid the war in Ukraine. They could sell burgers branded as Big Macs, for example, but it wouldn't be the same food. As such, McDonald's is facing down a decade that has the potential to unravel 30 years of brand building in the country. McDonald's has closed its stores in the Ukraine and Russia, but continues to pay the salaries of its workers in Ukraine and its 62,000 Russian employees. So good for them, I think. Executives have since said the company will lose $50 million each month that the Russian stores are closed. So here's the impact of factors outside the firm. These would be hard to plan for. If the stores reopen and serve food that is not up to McDonald's standards, customers might not know why the quality of food has gone downhill, depending on how much access they have to the news. This confusion could continue if and when McDonald's reopens its stores or takes control of them again. So what might this change in government policy, regulation, legal do to the brand's long-term reputation and brand image there? The threat, of course, stands for other companies that have suspended imports into Russia as well. So that was sort of my add-on, given the world situation. Finally, this was too cool to ignore. How many of you guys heard about this image that I'm showing here from the right-hand side, this QR code? Anyone know what I'm talking about here yet? You do? This is a bunch of drones in the sky that have been programmed to shape in a working QR code. Wow. The rest of it was cool, too. So an alien drone swarm formed a giant hovering QR code over Austin to promote Halo. Any Halo players? Halo? What do you guys do in your spare time? You have to write me. This is what an alien invasion from a marketing department looks like, getting consumers' attention. An eerie swarm of purple lights amassed in the skies over downtown Austin, Texas, Sunday evening. 400 drones were suspended over the city during the South by Southwest Festival to form a giant hovering QR code. The dystopic yet impressive stunt came courtesy of Paramount Plus to promote its upcoming sci-fi series Halo, based on the popular Xbox game about a warrior fighting off an alien invasion. The display was 300 feet tall, roughly the height of the Statue of Liberty, 600 feet wide, almost two football fields, and yes, the QR code was scannable, linking to a trailer for this series. So obviously this is promotion at a major event, generating publicity. Halo had its premiere at the South by Southwest Film Festival and debuts on Paramount Plus on March 24th. So this is, of course, a new product launch. Here's what it looked like. Yeah, where's my audio?
Austin for South by Southwest.
You can't hear
Halo
much.
QR code made out of drones. That's clickable. It works.
He's just talking about it. So that's what it looked like in the sky.
QR code in the sky above Austin, Southwest.
So pretty cool. And then they had the drones do some other looks as well. So that's certainly getting attention for your new product launch with 400 lit up drones in the sky. So very cool marketing of the future, I guess. So we pick up with lecture notes, page 150 and page 279 of the textbook, chapter 10. We're going to wrap that up and go to 11, developing new products and services, if I have that all right. So we just finished up with Fred Hunt talking about a new product idea at Sherwin-Williams. Last time, as we were talking about the stages in the new development process. So on to from where we left off, stage three, we've come up with these ideas. And now we're moving to screening and evaluation. So we're going to have to do the stuff we talked about when we talked about segmentation, determining on good segmentations and determining good target markets. What's the market potential out there? Is there enough demand in terms of numbers and dollars or not? Check to see if the product fits in the company mission and competencies. To go back on my past example, you don't want blasting petons if you're who? What's the company I keep using as the example, the outdoor company? What is it? What? Patagonia. Thank you. If you're Patagonia, it doesn't fit. So does this new idea fit? Consider the effects on other products. If that new paint can that we saw Fred talk about last time was going to cannibalize, just replace all existing thin bale wire paint cans, then what's the point of developing the entire new paint can? It's got to not cannibalize your existing product line. You have to think about that. Can you get the raw materials? I don't know what plastics were necessary for that, but were they available? What's your patent position? Can you protect this? Test it. as you screen and evaluate it, do the people who you did your ethnographic study with, who didn't like the idea of carrying that paint can and pounding it and having the paint, do they like this new idea? So concept test it. Okay, so if we get our idea through screening and evaluation to stage four, let's do a more detailed business analysis. Check it against customer needs overall. Establish that target market. See what the competition is doing out there. Develop our segmentation targeting position. Develop our target positioning. Get our product specs into detail from our engineers. Perform the economic analysis overall. And then you're going to revise and refine all of this as you go through the process of modeling it, seeing what it suggests, and making changes. If it makes it through business analysis, you're on to stage five, the actual development. So now we're going to look at that supply chain and make sure that it's working. We all know now what happens when you have a screwed up supply chain. Not good thing. So for this new product, is the supply chain going to work okay? Can the manufacturing of this new thing work okay? Can we get quality specs done? Manufacturing control system processes in place? What do your marketing programs look like? Update costs and financial plans. Ensure that your target costs are met. Oftentimes, new products fail because we don't hit our costs as expected. The costs are too high, and you can't sell it to make enough profit at the price that people will buy it at. So you got to lock that down. You get through that development part one, move to development part two, create an actual prototype of the thing. Test it in labs. Get your consumer reaction to your planned marketing mix. Of course, feedback and revision, retest, reevaluate. Let's jump over to, I'm senile today, to our guy at Protégé talking about how things work in actual consumer use tests at Protégé.
What's really cool and interesting is in-home usage tests. We call it an iHUD. So it's really powerful because instead of saying, like, let's imagine you're a yogurt company, or maybe you're in the toothpaste industry. Instead of saying, hey, we've got in a survey, we have a mint flavor, we have a cherry flavor, we have a strawberry flavor. What do you think sounds most appealing? Instead, these companies that we partner with are actually able to recruit their target demographic. So let's say they're looking for 30 to 54-year-olds for the toothpaste study. Once those people are screened and they qualify for that study, then we'll confirm their physical address, and actually the company will be able to send out those products. And so then, again, this kind of goes back to the power of us owning those member data sets, because they're then able to recontact them and follow up and say, okay, so you were testing that toothpaste for the last week. What did you like? What didn't you like? Did you like the flavors? Did you like, you know, how it foamed, et cetera, and actually get that real experience and feedback so that you can actually make those informed decisions. And that's been super powerful for our clients. Yeah, it's really cool. And so much to the point that I'm starting to ask, like, why don't we work with apparel companies? Like, why wouldn't an apparel company send out either images of threads or whatever, or, you know, particular pieces of clothes, because they can make more informed decisions instead of like, hey, we didn't sell 1,000 shirts last year because nobody liked it.
There you go, fashion students. Take up Patrick on his idea at Protégé. So this is real feedback on your ideas. You haven't had to go to the full cost of putting out a manufacturing line yet, but you get a few prototypes, you get them tested, and you get real feedback from the consumers. Excellent. Now, it depends on your situation whether you go from products that get through stage five to stage six, test market, or in some cases directly to commercialization. But let's look at stage six, the idea of test marketing. So here we're going to find an appropriate city, region, whatever we're talking about, with the appropriate target demographics that we expect this thing to work on, that we've researched, and we're going to roll out the promotion that we have in mind. We're going to see how our media is working. We're going to see whether or not the members of the channel accept the product. We're going to test our prices, maybe in a couple different markets. We're going to see, having bought that toothpaste or kumquat flavored ding dong, or what was your example, John, Dave? I forget. What was your example? Strawberry? Oh, Starlight.
Yeah, Starlight Coca-Cola.
Starlight Coca-Cola, if that's a test. Do people come back and buy it again, or do they just buy it on a one time only? Now you begin, because you're hopefully doing things right, to build product inventories, get an additional distribution channels out there in other areas, revise as needed, feedback and revise, or if that's not practical because of technical difficulties, problems getting in the channel distribution, you don't want to reveal yourself to the competition who's going to see what's going on with your new product in your test market, maybe you can do some kind of simulated test marketing. Or if none of those are appropriate for you, then you just go directly out to stage 7, launch. Ramp up your production. Ramp up your purchasing of all these raw materials. Activate your quality focus control systems. Anybody taken operations management? Did we talk about that? I think I mentioned that periodically. Nobody's taken it. So make sure that your operations are doing what they need to do to make things right. Get that sales force and service personnel trained so they're able to sell the product and service the consumer. Have meetings with your channel distribution dealers. Run trade ads as well as customer ads. Have a press conference because it's so exciting to get the word out about this new launch. And then finally, stage 8, which they don't mention in the book, but they should, evaluation of how it all went. Okay? So analyze the sales data. How does it match what you expected? Analyze your profit position. Were you able to get your costs down and your revenue going so you got the profits you wanted? Revise your promotion mix, adjust the product specs to foamy, different tastes, reallocate the sales force as necessary given the results, and then over time phase out the weak items and go back to continuous improvement, because either new models, new additions, new flavors, new entire products are necessary for growth and existence. Innovate or die. Yeah? Okay. So, here we are recapping where we were. So, we're in our overall strategic marketing management system. We got down to the product or service. We got the marketing program out there. We're now seeing the marketing response for this new product. And now we're getting feedback and going up through evaluation and control, changing things as necessary. Now, why do new products fail? Well, for a variety of different reasons. One reason is people look at it and they say, meh, there's no particular advantage here. I don't get it. What I got is doing it just fine. Competitive reaction. You revealed your hand to the competition, and I guess your patent position wasn't very strong, and boom, they jump on whatever it is you're selling. The original iPhone was pretty unique when it came out. I think everybody else had flip phones at that time. What happened pretty quickly after they came out with that smartphone, though? Everybody and their mother came out with a new smartphone. Badly positioned, the brand image that you build in the mind of the consumer doesn't mean anything to them. It's not relevant. Sometimes you get just poor quality. Our operations management team didn't do what they needed to do. Person buys a new product. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. I've said before, we see that sometimes in the software we buy. Things don't work as they should. But in almost any product, you go out there and there's a whole bunch of 5-star reviews and there's a bunch of people that had a 1-star review. And often it has to do with the quality of whatever they got in particular. Some were good, some were not. Doesn't deliver the promised benefits. Too little marketing support. There's no synergy in what you've rolled out as your program. There's no real perceived value in what you're offering. I have an example here coming up from two different versions of a brand's televisions. This was one version early on.
At Sharp, our goal is to reproduce every color in the world on TV. Introducing Quatron Quadpixel technology. It adds a fourth color, yellow, to the standard RGB color system, creating a vast array of colors you can't see with your TV's three-color technology. But you can see this. Whoa! Oh my!
Quatron from Sharp. You have to see it to see it.
And indeed, that would be the marketing problem. You have to see it to see it. Now, let me ask you this. How many times have you sat at home watching your TV set, shaking your head, and said, boy, there's not enough yellow in that picture? Never. It's not a thing. Then, if you're marketing it, where are you going to see the yellow that you can't see? You might see it on your computer. You see it on your television screen. You can see the yellow. What are they talking about? It wasn't a big seller. Now, they're not a foolish company. That didn't work well, but they did move into other things that were relevant, that offered better positioning, better value.
The future of TV is here.
Mm-hmm.
Oculus, world's first 8K resolution TV. There's nothing like it.
Okay, well, I may not be able to see the 8K, not 8K, 8K results on my TV. I get the concept, and occasionally I look at my TV and things look blurry. I got that concept, and so I can see why a sharper image might be something I'd want. I can see the yellow. I just never sat around saying, boy, I wish I had more yellow. So, was there an advantage? Was it positioned well? Did it have a benefit we wanted? Was there perceived value? Also, we have the idea of not very good estimates of marketing potential or other marketing research errors can cause products to fail. Forecasts are dangerous, especially when they're about the future. And when we don't have a good estimate of market potential, we can't figure out our costs right because we're expecting a long production run and it's going to cut down on our unit costs and increase our profit, and it doesn't come out that way. Poor estimates of production and or marketing costs, so it costs us more to do the marketing than we expect. Poor selection of marketing channels, it doesn't get to our target audience the way it's supposed to. Rapid change in the marketing environment, by the time we get this exciting new product out, it's old hat. Whoops! Somebody else already got ahead of us. let's take a look at some famous marketing or new product flops over time. Some of these are old, but they're amusing. Classic examples.
Hi, I'm Mimi Chahaman for 24/7 Wall Street, and today we're taking a look at some of the worst product flops of all time. Big companies sometimes have to take big risks and spend big bucks to find the next it product. But those attempts aren't always successful. In fact, they can sometimes be downright epic failures. To identify some of the worst product flops of all time, 24/7 Wall Street reviewed products introduced by America's largest companies from 1950 onwards. Here's a look at the worst five. At number 5, it's Wow Chips. Made with the fat substitute Olestra, Wow Chips were marketed as a healthier snacking option and public perception followed until Olestra turned out not to be the miracle ingredient consumers initially believed it to be. At number 4, it's Hot Wheels and Barbie computers. As part of an attempt to reconcile the declining sales of Barbie dolls and growing sales of software and CD-ROMs, Mattel joined forces with Patriot Computers, but manufacturing flaws were ultimately their undoing. At number 3, it's Easy Squirt Ketchup. Heinz added a little color to its game with this range of differently colored ketchup and matching squeeze bottles aimed at youngsters, who ate it up, but for less than 6 years. At number 2, it's the touchpad. Hewlett-Packard's answer to Apple's iPad was unveiled with an extremely costly, celebrity-filled advertising campaign. Sales, however, didn't come close to matching the roughly $15 billion marketing budget. And at number 1, it's Google Glass. Google Glass was introduced on the principle that technology should be there when you need it and get out of your way when you don't. After 2 years of disappointing sales, it was clear that consumers did not need Google Glass. And there you have it, the 5 worst product flops of all time.
And we see almost all of the things we talked about. Marketing budgets being more than we expected, so we can't make a profit. Manufacturing not doing what it was supposed to do for the Barbie example. Not delivering the promised benefits. The Olestra thing that was not non-fat, gave people cramps and diarrhea. Not the promise that people wanted from a brand. So these are things that indeed cause new products to fail. So research, research, research. Change things. Feedback, evaluate, move forward. All right. That is the chapter on new product introductions. So presumably we've gotten our new product out to the marketplace, but now we've added it to a portfolio of things that we have to manage. And so this takes us to chapter 11, Managing Products and Brands. I think it's lecture notes, page 156, if I got it right. So let me go through a somewhat overwrought, overblown, too much material example of a brand I think most of us know, Starbucks, and how they've successfully managed that puppy over a pretty good time period with some ups and downs. So in the early years, the first Starbucks was opened in Seattle, Washington on March 30th, 1971. If that's a picture of me in front of it, or if that's just a standard picture. Their goal was to sell high-quality coffee beans for people to use in making coffee at home. In 1982, Howard Schultz became the new director of retail operations and marketing. And Howard takes a trip over to Milan, Italy. Looks around, sees what's going on in that environment. He comes back and he says to the owners that the company should sell coffee and espresso in the store to drink, in addition to the whole bean coffee, leaf teas, and spices that they had been offering. Seems like good advice given what we know. Yeah, it was, you know, he saw this going on in Milan, Italy, people drinking coffee at coffee shops. Guess what the owners said? No way. The owners rejected this idea. They felt that getting into the beverage business would distract the company from its primary focus. To them, coffee was something to be prepared in people's homes. Now, they did give away little free samples of pre-made drinks for people to taste, but that wasn't their goal. So sure, Schultz was pretty sure there was a market for pre-made drinks that you would drink in a coffee shop. So he started Il Giornale, a coffee bar chain, in April of 1986. In 1987, the original Starbucks management decided to forget about Starbucks and focus instead on Peet's Coffee and Tea. So they said, what are we going to do with this old Starbucks brand? We'll sell it to Schultz, and we'll sell it for $3.8 million. He bought it. Today it's worth about $26 billion, probably more by the since the time I put this together. So Schultz made a pretty good decision. Schultz rebranded his new coffee bars, the Il Giornale, with Starbucks' name, and he aggressively expanded the Starbucks reach across the United States, managing the brand for growth, right? Starting from 17 Seattle-based stores in 1987, Schultz initially expanded rapidly to other cities, Vancouver, Portland, Chicago. By 1999, Starbucks had also expanded into the mail order catalog business, and they licensed airport stores to sell their product and expanded further into the state of California. By 92, Starbucks had grown to 165 outlets. The first international location for Starbucks was in Tokyo in 1996. And when I put this together, Starbucks is present in more than 50 countries with more than 24,000 stores worldwide, including more than 13,300 in the U.S. So the guy's done okay in terms of growth of stores, growth of the company, yeah? Now, how does he manage the product and brand extensions over time? Well, in the early 90s, they first used the internet to offer people the option to purchase Starbucks coffee online. In 2009, they first offered up Via, Starbucks Via. Anybody know what Starbucks Via is? Starbucks Via? We'll see in a minute. I'm just curious if you know what it is. It's an instant coffee. It's a pouch coffee you pour in, stir it up. It's supposed to have the same taste as a cup of Starbucks. 1995, they offered Starbucks a coffee on United Airlines flights. They produced premium coffee ice cream in co-partnership, co-branding with Dreyer's. In 97, they introduced Starbucks Barista Home Espresso Machine, featuring a new portafiller system that accommodated both ground coffee and Starbucks' new ready-to-use espresso pods. 98, they offered chai tea latte, a combination of black tea, exotic spices, honey, and milk. In 98, they also distributed whole bean and ground coffee out to supermarkets. So picture all the activity that's going on at corporate headquarters to make all these decisions over time. 99, they sold premium teas through Starbucks-owned Tazo Tea Company. 2005, they began selling CDs in Starbucks retail stores because in 99, they had purchased Hear Music as a record label and music marketer. 2008, they started a community website, My Starbucks Idea, to collect suggestions and get feedback from consumers. 2008, they introduced a loyalty program. 2009, they introduced this new line of instant coffee packets called Via Ready Brew. In talking about this new idea, Via CEO Howard Schultz says that the instant coffee won't tarnish Starbucks' premium image, but for less than a dollar a cup, people can have a cup of coffee that's the mirror image of Starbucks. When I've talked to people who've tasted Via, they say, maybe not exactly mirroring the image of a cup of Starbucks, but it's okay for instant coffee. 2010, Starbucks diversifies Seattle's best. Starbucks, the premium coffee chain, is expanding further into the mass market, lower-priced coffee brands that will help compete with the alternatives offered by players like McDonald's and McCafe. Buoyed by the success of Via, Starbucks is making its second strategic move into mass market coffees by revamping the Seattle's best coffee brand to compete against McDonald's. McDonald's came into direct competition with Starbucks when it upgraded its coffee in 2006. What have I said to you before? When a company sees another company doing well and having good market share, they want a piece of that action. McDonald's wasn't really known for their, for their coffee prior to all this interaction, this competition. But 2006, the lower priced option for McDonald's became popular among price sensitive consumers and created new competition for Starbucks. As a result, the average number of customers visiting a Starbucks store declined from an estimated 460 in 2005 to just above 400 in 2007. So there was a segment of the population that wanted a less expensive coffee experience. Starbucks did a strong launch of its Seattle's best brand coffee at more than 30,000 fast food outlets, supermarkets, and coffee houses. The company's expansion plans includes featuring Seattle's best at convenience stores, drive-through kiosks, and vending machines. Through Seattle's best, Starbucks can sell cheaper coffee without cheapening the Starbucks name. So again, a strategic decision. They could have called it Starbucks Light, Starbucks Store, Starbucks Other, whatever. They chose not to use the Starbucks brand name on it to help try to keep the brand image of Starbucks as what it was, and then to reach the lower priced market, the lower cost market with the Seattle's best name. The ball, back then, was now in McDonald's court. As the chain remodels and upgrades the interiors of hundreds of restaurants, the next move, bringing Wi-Fi into the shops, is progressing, pretty much is there by now. And at year's end, over one-third of the shops worldwide were online. This is possibly the best news for customers, as they now in many areas can have a burger and fries with their specialty coffee as they surf the internet, ignoring the pandemic. But of course, eventually you've got to chase them out of the store. They're just sitting there using your internet. But not everything works. If you're a busy company trying a bunch of new product ideas, they aren't all successful. So in 2012, Starbucks paid about $620 million for Teavana, hoping to jumpstart the next wave of growth in this dynamic beverage category. They brought the Teavana brand into Starbucks locations, held on to Teavana's own retail stores, and even opened a few high-end Teavana fine teas, tea bars. There was one up at Beachwood. Anybody ever see it at Beachwood Mall? Anybody ever see that one at Beachwood Mall? Yeah, they closed all that out. But the business still wasn't doing well enough for Starbucks to keep it. In July 2017, Starbucks announced its plans to shut all 379 Teavana stores over the coming year, with the majority of Teavana-only stores set to close by the spring of 2018. Well, that was only $620 million gone. Just go away. They don't all work. 2016 fall, growing single-serve serving pods, in addition to inking a new agreement with Keurig Green Mountain Inc. to sell K-Cups in more channels in North America. Began in 2012 in Walmart stores. Starbucks plans to launch branded pods for the Nestle's Nespresso machines in international markets later in that year. And there were many, many, many ads, posters, etc. for this product in Europe. Now, what about our image? Well, our image in part is caught up with our packaging, caught up with our logo. So how do we manage our logo over this time period? I trust we don't recognize that logo, not one we're familiar with for Starbucks. The original logo from 1971 to 1987, created in 1971, was fashioned after a 15th century Norse woodcut. It had the image of a mythical two-tailed mermaid siren on it. That's what's there in the middle. It had a coffee brown scheme, since it's coffee. The circular ring surrounding the mythological mermaid figure contained the text Starbucks, coffee, tea, spices. The overall image was designed to resemble a cigar band label. The symbolism of the mermaid siren was intended to suggest the irresistible and seductive quality of the coffee itself. Sirens called sailors to their island. Anybody know what happened after the sailors got to the island? They would kill them. Yeah, so I guess we skipped over that part of the myth when we built the image. But the seductive quality of fooling customers to the coffee. 87 to 92, when Howard Schultz purchased Starbucks in 87, the Starbucks logo was cleaned up a bit. a little more befitting a new corporate image. The bare breasts were covered up by the mermaid's flowing hair, although her belly button is still visible. The color scheme was changed from a coffee brown in the original logo to the familiar green that Schulz had established with his Il Giornale logo. The text in the surrounding circular band was changed simply to, as you can see, Starbucks coffee. Okay, little change from that to that, a little cleaner image maybe, more corporate identity, but 92 to 2011, they did a third revision. In 92, it crops the image of the mermaid with a closer up view of her. Her navel is no longer visible. The mermaid's tails on either side are mostly obscured, which creates some mystery if you didn't follow this progression. People wondered what those were, what it meant, why, you know, why, what's that image? So some people were puzzled by that image. 2011, for its 40th anniversary, Starbucks debuted the most recent logo, which brings the iconic mermaid out of the circle and drops the word Starbucks coffee. My goodness. How do we know it's Starbucks anymore? Well, remember we talked about learning. We have spent so much time linking up that image of that mermaid and the green color to Starbucks. It becomes what comes to people's mind when they see it. It embraces and respects our heritage. At the same time, it evolves us to a point we feel is more suitable for the future. The fact that it's no longer tied to the English language makes it more marketable on an international level. Very cool. Also, we've dropped the fact that it's tea and spices and coffee. It's whatever we're selling in our store, including sandwiches and other things as well, right? Competition rears its ugly face. We already touched on that. In 2007, customer traffic declined for the first time since the company went public, sending the stock tumbling. 2008, the Great Recession. Starbucks found itself in an economic climate that had most people reassessing their daily spending habits on luxury items. The company's revenues and profits tumbled as people in the recession stopped spending on such an expensive luxury. Starbucks was hurt by rising costs, the cannibalization effects of years of overexpansion, and stiff competition in espresso drinks from the likes of McDonald's and Dunkin'. By the end of fiscal 2008, Starbucks stock, when seemingly invincible, had declined by, ouch, over 50%. We better get some management going on for this. So, in 2008, they oust their chief executive, James L. Donald, and bring back Mr. Schulz, who seems to understand the brand pretty well, to try to invigorate the company. Mr. Schulz laid off 1,000 employees, closed 600 underperforming locations. I pause for a minute to say, if I haven't said already, when economic times are good, there's an expression, a rising tide raises all ships. Have you ever heard that expression? And the notion is, when economic times are good, good stores and poor stores do okay because everything's growing and revenue's increasing and people are buying more. It's when the economic tide begins to sink that the poor stores look really bad. They fail faster. And Starbucks had overextended. Who's been to Manhattan, seen a Starbucks on this corner, that corner, and down the block, and then there again, and then inside two buildings? Too much Starbucks at this point in time. So closed 600 underperforming locations in the U.S. while scaling back the rate of store openings domestically. At the same time, Starbucks moved aggressively to open stores overseas where, during this time, business remained robust. It also introduced new discount programs like the $25 gold card, which offered 10% off on all items. The strategy sparked a comeback for the coffee powerhouse. In 2010, Starbucks' profit was $948 million. In 2011, it was up over 14% to $1.7 billion. Go Howard Schulz. 2008, McDonald's announced that they'll take on Starbucks, installing coffee bars complete with baristas in its 14,000 U.S. locations. I have to admit, I never saw a McDonald's barista. Did anybody see a barista in McDonald's anywhere? It was the concept. It wasn't how it played out, but McCafe played out pretty well for them. McDonald's and Starbucks had two diverse customer bases until McCafe was born of McDonald's and specialty coffee married fast food. While for the most part, customer bases are still apart, the McDonald's shopper is a little different than the Starbucks shopper in general. It's the middle ground where customers could go either way. That is the war's focus. It's been easier for McCafe to hone in on specialty coffee than for Starbucks to compete in the fast food arena. Most Starbucks outlets don't have kitchens, so the food is of the wrapped sandwich variety and pastry type. Slowly, the company is implementing ovens, so at least some foods can be warmed up to be served hot. The one that's down the hill here at the bottom is at Summit Street, I think. I remember when they first got in their first oven to be first be able to warm anything up, a new thing for them. Duncan, of course, wants some of this action. So 2011, American runs on Duncan, the tagline for the ever-popular Canton. For a long time, I thought it was Canton, Ohio-based. It's Canton, Massachusetts-based. Canton-based donut and coffee chain can soon be interpreted more literally as the 2011 IPO, initial public offering of Duncan. Brand Groups looks to raise over $400 million. The money will be used in part to build out the brand beyond its northeastern stronghold, where they will look to compete with the likes of McDonald's and Starbucks Corporation. In 2011, the recession was considered a hamburger and beer consumption period. The proof was that the success of McDonald's sales 2007, 8, and 9. McDonald's did well in both the U.S. and overseas. Analysts attribute that to the fast food company's decision to keep their prices low in the recession and the addition of the new line of coffees to compete with Starbucks. They were clever enough to price their coffee products below those Starbucks customers had to pay. They could have gone a different route, but again, price is an important part of that marketing mix. Are we actually targeting the exact same customer who buys Starbucks? No, there's a difference in our target audience than theirs. Let's be sure we price it appropriately to appeal to our segment rather than try to price it to match them. The McDonald's plan, which was copied by Dunkin', was credited with taking market share from Starbucks. The twin problems of the recession and McDonald's success caused Starbucks to fire 12,000 people and close hundreds of stores. The company's new earnings report is a testament to the turnaround under Howard Schultz, who returned to CEO when Starbucks was in trouble. Anybody remember Mrs. Fields cookies? Is that, a couple people do. So Mrs. Fields, in 2011, decided to get in the action too, to test specialty coffees in Chicago for the generation that came of age in the 80s. No trip to the mall seemed to be complete without a visit to Mrs. Fields, or at least a pause in front of the store to savor the wafting scent of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies. A lot has happened since the 1980s, including the chain's bankruptcy in 2008, the rise and fall of Krispy Kreme, Starbucks domination, lattes at McDonald's, and dozens of other food and beverage trends. Mrs. Field now has 280 stores in the U.S., but once had 100 more, but they get into the specialty coffee business as well. 2012, McDonald's is betting consumers will get tired of spending so much for Starbucks lattes that they'll be willing to slum it on something just as frothy. The fast food chain has started to shift its focus from food to pricey beverages because the latter are driving revenue more than ever, which it's still doing today, as we just heard about their plans for McCafe globally. In fact, it's to the point where Starbucks had better start viewing the fast food chain as serious competition. For summer 2012, McDonald's is introducing the McCafe Cherry Berry Chiller and the McCafe Frappe Chocolate Chip, $2.89 and $3.99. Starbucks Frappuccino is more expensive, $5.45 for a 16-ounce cup, than McDonald's version, but some say these ice-blended drinks are still a lot for a fast food restaurant. Anybody ever have a Cherry Berry Thriller or a Frappe Chocolate Chip at McDonald's? You've had which one? Yeah, pretty good? Yeah, okay. Any good price for you? Oh, your mom bought it. well, there you go. I don't care about the price. Mom bought it. That's okay. Family decision making. All right. The point of this overly long, overwrought example, but I sort of like it, changing consumer tastes and competition require marketers to actively and successfully manage their products and brands, a point we made before and a point which we emphasize now. You've got to keep up with what's going on. Yeah? All right, what we find is due to these situations, consumer tastes, competition, products don't stick around forever. They have a life cycle. So this is one of our key terms in marketing, a product life cycle. The top line above the gray line is our sales. And you can see that when we're doing that initial new product development, what are the sales? Nothing. You haven't rolled it out yet. You're developing it. So there are no sales. Does it cost you money to develop that new product? It does. So how are your revenues looking during the new product development? There are no revenues. There's only expenses. So that is the green line under the gray line early on. So we're spending money, developing that new product. And eventually, we begin to introduce it, the introduction stage of the product life cycle. And we still are spending a bunch of money. We're ramping up production. We're ramping up inventory. We're training people. We're running advertisements to consumers. We're running advertisements to industry. So in the early stage of the product life cycle, almost to the end of the early, to the introductory stage of the product life cycle, we're still losing money. Hope we make some money here soon. So now, assuming things go well, we haven't crashed and burned, we begin to see an increase into the growth phase of the product life cycle, when finally we start making some money, making profits on this initial investment. Yeah? Over time, what happens is the product goes to maturity, sales begin to peak and go down, and you can see profits have begun to peak, and they're going to drop down until we get to that decline stage. Consumer tastes move on, technology moves on, competition moves on, and we move into decline stage. So this is the aggregate demand over an extended period of time for all brands in a generic product class. Your company may have crashed and burned in the early days. Others are continuing. So this is the aggregate idea across the whole industry, yeah? Not just one company. And it's been shown to be true across a lot of products. The product life cycle and the profit curves will vary from product category to product category, but this is a basic shape. We'll talk about other shapes in a little bit. The basic shape that we see, slow growth, or slow in the introduction stage, rapid growth, and eventual drop off. We have negative profits early on when we're doing product development and introduction, so we need sales to offset the product development cost and the cost of getting the product out there. So hopefully you've done a good job of what? Segmenting, target marketing, positioning, advertising to get those sales going to offset all those costs. As we go into that growth stage, I've already said to you, competition is rearing its ugly head. They see what's going on. They're no fools. They want part of what's going on. And so as we begin to grow, competition is coming in. And so we've got to increase our advertising and selling efforts, cut our prices in the face of competition, helping to begin that profit curve to start down, because we have to fight off competition as we move along this product life cycle. When do I enter this new market? Do I create the new market? What if it's an entirely brand new product that nobody knows anything about? That I got to develop that brand new product. I got to think about how I'm going to get people to know what it is. That's a lot of risk. That's a lot of money spent. Maybe I'll be the market leader. Maybe people will associate this new thing with me. Or do I hang back and see if this thing's successful or not? And once I see how it's going, do I come in later? After the first person, and maybe I take over from them. So deciding when to enter the market can impact your profitability. It depends on the situation. When's a good time to enter? This is an actual graph based on digital cameras as a product category. So Sony launched the Mavica still camera with magnetic recording system in 1981, in anticipation of the arrival of the magnetic recording still camera era, Canon formed a task force to develop a magnetic recording color still camera in October of 1981. So here we have digital cameras at their very start. We move along in time. The first commercially marketed still video camera, digital camera, came out in 86 with a list price of $2,458. Who's going to spend that kind of money for a new camera? Innovators, people who can't afford risk, want to afford risk, see this as being exciting for them. The rest of us are going, I'll wait, thanks. Things move along. The Apple QuickTake 100 is launched in 94. It was actually manufactured by Kodak, who eventually fails in this whole arena, right? And the first color digital camera for under $1,000. It packed a 640 by 480 pixel CCD and could stash up to 8 images in its internal memory. Holy mackerel, 8. Fantastic. 94. The 95 Casio QV10 was new, and it was the first with an LCD screen on the back. Other now familiar features of this 95 model, including macro positioning, automatic exposure, automatic playback of images, and a self-timer for a mere $1,000. Smart media card and compact flash cards arrived in 96. The first camera to use the compact flash was the Kodak DC25 at a mere $499. Ah, prices begin to drop over time as technology develops, as the innovations develop. The Canon PowerShot G1, released in 2000, listed at Best Buy for $800. Again, things move along. But eventually, it all goes away. Digital camera sales have dropped since 84. Why? Because you people and your nasty cell phones ruining my digital camera business. So the first cell phones with built-in digital cameras were produced in 2000 by Sharp and Samsung. Apple iPhone, released in 2007. iPhone 4S in 2011. So digital camera sales dropped by 84% since 2010, down to a very minimal amount of product, the product life cycle at work. Just a restatement of what smartphones have done to the camera, to the digital camera industry. So new competition, changing consumer taste, technology have an impact on how the product life cycle plays out. I'm just showing you a new technology in the growth stage of the product life cycle. Number of digital voice assistants in use in the world from 2019 projected to 2023 in billions. Virtual assistants have become a key component of the smart device industry, integral to the way that all consumers interact with their devices, and it's growing into more areas than just phones. All right, so what does this mean for us as we think about how we're going to manage stuff? So in the introduction stage of the product life cycle, who are our customers? Who's willing to pay those big bucks for a new product? Innovators. People who have the resources to spend on the expensive new product. The competition, if this is a new-to-the-world product, is little, if any, because, well, we're brand new. Sales are low, but hopefully they're beginning to rise. And our profits, nada, we're still losing money. So what does this mean for us? We have to develop the market. Hey, people, here's what this is. Here's why it's good. It's better than what you got. It's really exciting. You should try this thing. Cost initially, because we have a lot of waste. We haven't gotten to the benefits of making large purchases yet of our costs, so high cost per unit. Product strategy, since there is no competition, we're really the only one out there, is undifferentiated. We're the only ones doing it. Pricing strategy is almost always going to be high in that early stage of the product life cycle when you can get those innovators to spend a lot of money. Distribution, scattered. Your channels of distribution are going, you want to sell me, you want to sell what? You want me to give up store space to sell what on my shelves? I don't know if it's going to sell. No thanks. So you got to convince them to carry it. And we're trying to build category awareness for this thing. Hey, guys, this is what it is. So how many of you guys have heard of a 3D printer? Heard of 3D printers. How many of you guys have a 3D printer, used a 3D printer? Ever used it? How many of you guys have one at home? Well, wouldn't it be cool to have one at home and be able to produce all that stuff that would be fun, toys and broken pieces? We don't, haven't done that yet. 3D printers, $34.99 from Form Labs, a mere $12.50 from Loosebot, MakerBot at $28.99, and $28.99 from Ultimaker. So these are priced very high. I imagine they'll drop down over time. And I imagine eventually you'll have fun with making a toy. Do you know they can actually do food? You can actually feed food product into it or create like a candy or whatever. No? Stuff coming. Stuff coming. All right, early stage of the product life cycle. So we're going to try to stimulate demand for the entire product category rather than a single brand because nobody knows what the thing is yet. Growth stage of the product life cycle. Things are taking off. Things are moving along. The innovators are all used up. They're done with you. They already bought the new thing. It's been around for a while. So now we move over to the mass market. Competition is paying attention. Oh, look what he's doing. He seems to be making money on that thing. I think I want a piece. So competition begins to increase. Sales, because it is the growth stage of the product life cycle, are increasing rapidly. Profits, we saw from our chart, are strong, and then they're going to peak because pretty soon we're going to have to start spending money to fight off competition. So we're trying to get into that market. We're trying to penetrate the market with our particular version of the product against competition. Our costs are beginning to decline. We have moved down that learning curve. We have less waste. We've got economies of scale. So hopefully, especially for the market leader, our prices are lower than other people. Product strategy against competition, and because we've been out for a while, is going to be improved. New product features. Pricing strategy is going to go lower over time as we fight off the competition, and our prices drop. Distribution strategy intensive. Folks want it. They're buying it, and our dealers want to carry it. And the promotional strategy is to build brand preference for our brand against the competition that's out there, because we have to fight them off. As profits fall, more resources are needed to attract customers away from other offers, the competition, and so they continue to fall in the face of competition during this stage. Maturity. We've been around for a long time. You know who we are. You've been with us for a while. You know what we do. So it's the mass market. Competition is intense. Everybody who wants in has gotten in, and they're fighting one another. Sales are slow to no annual growth, maybe beginning to fall down, and our profits continue to decline from their peaks because we continue to have to fight off competition. So we're going to have a defensive position against these other competitors that are out there. Our costs are stable, or as we have to keep changing products, changing colors, increasing features, maybe they're increasing a bit. Our product strategy is differentiated as we come out with these new features, new flavors, new versions to differentiate ourselves from competition. The pricing strategy is probably becomes, over this mature stage, the lowest we're going to see it. Distribution strategy, again, is intensive. And we're going to play to brand loyalty. We've been here. You've bought us before. You don't care for those other guys. We're the one you want. Coca-Cola Raspberry. It's a new little tweak, but you know who we are. Come by us or Starlight. So firms attempt to differentiate themselves from the massive competition that's out there. Coca-Cola Starlight flavor. Decline stage of the product life cycle. So why do brands decline? Over time, eventually, technology changes perhaps, and we get better products out there than the one that we were able to create, or less expensive products that meet the same need, even better sometimes. Or the need for the product completely disappears due to product development over time. So we get into decline stage. Board games, wildly popular in the 50s, the 60s, I don't know about the 70s. What are they replaced by for many people? Video games, right? So we're now playing video games. Of course, there's still some board games out there. There's still a segment that likes board games, but not the way they used to. And what's more, now you can get Monopoly on a video game. I mean, it becomes, they moved it over, right? So we find decline there. Who knows what that thing on the left is? What is it? A juicer, yeah. And indeed, that used to be the way you got fresh juice. There was no other way to do it. Juice. Anybody still have one of those at home? How about your parents? Anybody have parents have them at home? And then they got fancier. So technology came in if you wanted to go the high-end route. But initially, that was the only way you could get your juice. Then they invent concentrate frozen juice. Does anybody remember the Minute Maid in the freezer? You take it, and you dump it out, and then you have to stir it up. And it's never really as good as the real thing, but okay. Then they came out with the stuff not from concentrate, the original stuff in a container. And we would argue that not so many people need to have the squeezer anymore if you like your orange juice. All right, so better or less expensive product meet the same need. The need for the product disappears due to product development. So in the decline stage, who are going to buy it? Loyal customers. Sometimes just for nostalgia. It's what I did when I was a kid. It's how my mom made orange juice. Whatever. Loyal customers. Competition's decreasing. It's not really worth it to stay there. There's not much of a market. Sales are declining. It is the decline stage of the product life cycle. Profits are pretty low at this point, to none, depending how big you are in the marketplace. So what are we going to try to do? We're going to try to get very efficient with what we're doing. We're not coming out with a lot of new flavors, a lot of new features. We're going to try to be very efficient with what we're making, or exit, get out. Costs are low because we're not fighting off a lot of competition and not developing a lot of new versions of the product. We're going to prune our product line just to the ones that are selling to this declined market. Pricing. Now you might find the opportunity that there's not a lot of competition and you have a small loyal base. Maybe you can begin to bring your prices up a little bit. Probably not to where they were at their beginning, but you might be able to begin to increase your pricing. Distribution is selective. People aren't crazy about getting your product. And you're just going to reinforce once again that this is a product that you've known and loved. Most competitors are going to abandon the market. Enough is enough. I'm moving on. Some are able to stick around and develop a small, successful niche. So it depends on the situation. You guys ever see the pink flamingos out in people in front of people's yards? That company went out of business. It folded. And then was bought out by somebody who said, that's just too much fun. We got to continue that. They bought the molds, they bought the things, and so I guess pink flamingos are still around. Probably not in the huge demand they were at one point in time, but they're still there. How about this product on the top left? What is that?
It's a wood-burning
pot-bellied stove, which was, in the ancient days of America, the way that you heated your single-room cabin and cooked. Okay, so over time, of course, we're doing less of that. But they were still around for a while, and then pretty much they went away as a product. But how about the one on the right-hand side? It's a designer, if you will, wood-burning stove. And so they've actually been able to, not that we're rushing out to suddenly buy freestanding wood-burning stoves, but they've managed to refresh the market for a little niche who still likes that idea from a designer statement viewpoint. So sometimes you're able to do that. Now, when you look at the diagram I showed you, the product life cycle chart sort of suggested that those stages were of equal length as I drew it out. That's typically not the case. And certainly the overall time period, the overall length from introduction to decline varies quite a bit. So let's think about those two things for a minute. Fashion. So would you say that in any given time period, fashion has a very long product life cycle or a relatively short product life cycle? And how short is it? Usually about one season, and then it's gone. That's all your people's fault. You should. All right, so compare that to, say, playing cards. They were there in the Wild West. They might have been there before. They're still there today. A long product life cycle, yeah? It's a long time. So again, you have to consider what it is we're talking about as we think about how long is the product life cycle. It varies. But we also see differences in the shape. For most products, that introductory stage is going to take a long time. It's not going to be equal to the growth stage. Why? People don't know what you are. They aren't aware of you. They don't know what your product does. Retailers don't want to carry you because they don't know. It can take a long time to get that introduction stage going. I revert to an old example because at one point in time I sold microwave ovens. In an extended introduction stage example, in 1947, the first commercial microwave hit the oven. It was a primitive unit. It was gigantic, enormously expensive. It stood 5.5 feet tall, weighed 750 pounds, cost about $5,000 in 1947 dollars, and the magnetron tube had to be water-cooled, so you needed a plumbing installation. You can imagine this was not a big household item early on in the product life cycle. So they, of course, improve it. Technology improves. They begin making it smaller over time. It wasn't until 1975 that the sale of microwave ovens for the first time exceeded sales of gas ranges. 28 years after the introduction, it finally overtook, as it were, the competition. That's a pretty long time to stick with a product. On the other hand, very short product life cycles. We call those things typically fads, yeah? Who remembers Gangnam Style? Okay. Psy dancing around, released in 2012. It became the first YouTube video ever to reach
Oppan Gangnam Style.
Get to it,
Oppan Gangnam Style.
All right.
Gangnam Style.
Point is, it came and went. Reached a billion views, ignited a worldwide dance craze, and it's gone. Most of us are no longer doing Gangnam Style. Robo Sapien, it walks, it talks, it grabs stuff, it throws stuff. Heck, it can even do kung fu. Never heard of it. Well, that's because after its 2004 heyday, which saw 2 million units sold, the Robo Sapien took a nosedive. Pretty much a fad. Product life cycle, up, down, gone. Some other fads, we would say. Beanie Babies. Man, for a while, Beanie Babies were selling. You could buy one in a glass case. You could pay $1,000 for a Beanie Baby. That was the up end, of course. Today, not so much. Anybody remember Pogs? They're too old for you. You remember Pogs? Little cardboard circle things that you would collect, and you'd have a game out of it, and you put it in a stack, and you threw the thing, and if it fell outside the circle, you lost your Pogs, and they had to block them in schools because they were such a gambling problem for little kids in schools. Gone. So look down that list of things. How about these guys? Really, really big for a while, and now they may still be around a little bit, but mostly gone. Pokemon Go? How many people still doing Pokemon Go?
I just play the mainline Pokemon.
Okay. Well, Pokemon Go, though, for a while, there were people walking around, walking into cars as they were trying to chase down the Pokemon. Still around somewhat. And some have an indefinitely long maturity stage. Cards would be there. Refrigerator, what's the next big thing you're going to replace your refrigerator with? What? So they're still around. Coca-Cola, I mean, it's not growing, but it's still there. So some products, as opposed to having a very short product life cycle, have a very long one. All right, I think that's probably it for the day, so happy product life cycle to you and yours.